Hey, all, welcome back to the Fire and Water Cooking Podcast. Welcome to the best of 2020 episode. I have no new guests this week, and we're just going to play back some of the amazing guests that I've had in 2020 so that you can take a listen. If you want to hear the full episodes, just check out the full episodes on my podcast. I'll be right back.
Smoking, grilling, getting hot and hotter, sous vide and chilling from Fire and Water.
Hey, all, I want to introduce you to a company I just started working with, Fresh Jack's Organic Spices out of Jacksonville, Florida. They're a small, family-run company that's fast-growing. I've tried a bunch of their different seasoning blends and spices, and I can tell you they are all fresh, all organic. None of them contain artificial flavors or sweeteners. None of them have anti-caking agents or preservatives. They all taste like they were just made for you yesterday. Check them out, guys. They're on Amazon in the link below. They have different sample packs, different blends. Like I said, they also have the individual seasonings and spices as well. Fresh Jack's Organic Spices. Check them out, guys. I love them. All right, guys. So my first interview that I had that I want to put in the best of 2020 was, of course, my interview with Kenji Lopez Ault. He was a guest I'd been wanting to have on for a long time, was finally able to get him on. And some of the things that we talked about that I really love talking about with my guests is how they got started and what they're doing. And it was kind of a surprise to me that Kenji never really studied culinary arts in college or anything like that, that he worked pretty much learned everything that he learned on the job. So, all right, I'm going to play our clip with Kenji Lopez Ault and I'll be back. So I looking at your history, you really didn't study cooking in your early years. You went to college for architecture. So what got you involved in cooking?
It was a summer job, actually. You know, I was a biology major when I started college, and I'd spent a couple summers and winter break periods working in biology labs. I pretty quickly realized after working a few months in labs that lab work, which is what you basically do studying biology after school for a number of years, the lab work wasn't really up my alley. It was a little bit too slow paced for me. So I kind of decided then that I was not going to continue pursuing my biology degree. I was going to switch majors. So for the summer after that, the summer after my sophomore year, I didn't really know what to do. So I went around town looking for a job as a server, a waiter. I walked into a restaurant that needed a cook. It was actually called Fire and Ice, not Fire and Water, but Fire and Ice. It was like a Mongolian grill style place, in Harvard Square. I got a job as a prep cook there. Then eventually after a couple of weeks, I got promoted to Knight of the Round Grill. So I was one of those guys in the center with the big, with the big cast iron, grill that would take your food and grill it for you. Throw asparagus tips in the air with my spatulas and stuff like that. So it was just a summer job. I loved it. I loved everything about working in a kitchen. Everything from, the day-to-day, the mundane tasks, like peeling onions and chopping potatoes and all that stuff. To the adrenaline and the teamwork and the interfacing with customers, and the hospitality elements of it. So basically after that summer, I switched to an architecture degree, which I graduated with. Basically after that summer, I continued working in restaurants, either part or full time through college, and then went straight into them after college full time. Worked for a number of years in restaurants before switching over to the recipe writing and publishing side of it.
Now, did you ever attend any culinary classes or schools or anything like that? Is it strictly just a hands-on experience?
Yeah. Yep. All on the job. So, I worked in a huge variety of restaurants, ranging from Mongolian Grill to a pizza place to I was an oyster shucker at an oyster bar. I worked at a charcuterie bar, Spanish restaurants front, some high, more sort of high end French and Italian places. I tried to work as many different places as I could to get as much, get as much knowledge as I could. And I read a ton. I was also the I was a chef at a fraternity house. It was a co-ed fraternity house that was around 80% international students. And so I got a lot of opportunities to talk with students about foods from their homes. What I did there was I tried for the entire 2 years that I was working as a fraternity chef to never repeat the same meal. And every Sunday I would work with one of the students there to try and cook dishes from their home country for the rest of the house. So I got a lot of experience learning sort of firsthand what, food from various cultures around the world, which I found invaluable, because at the time, obviously I was just finished school and I was working as a line cook and I barely had any money. So traveling wasn't really,
right.
in the equation for me. So I felt that very lucky to have access to, interactions with so many people from around the world, to really sort of expand my, my repertoire of techniques and flavors and understanding of food.
Yeah. When I was young, when I first started in restaurants too, I mean, I think I was 16, I started washing dishes, and not too long after that, I was able to move to a line cook and I worked at different restaurants. I worked in about 10 years and I realized that you really couldn't support a family in that business. Like you said, when you're a line cook or something like that, it's kind of hard. You got to work two jobs to try to make ends meet.
Yep.
So I kind of changed careers and went into banking, but it did spark my love of cooking and I never gave that up. I've cooked my entire life and always, looked for different ways to cook so I can understand how you caught the bug, especially, if it's something that you're really passionate about. And that's what it sounds like to me, is that you thought you were going to do something else, but you got passionate about something and you made it into a career, even though that wasn't the path you were aiming for.
Yeah.
hit that fork in the road and went down a different one, which is great.
Yeah. That's always sort of been my philosophy whenever there's any kind of, career move or any kind of life decision. It's like, I've never really thought too hard about predefining a career path for myself. My sort of philosophy is like, as long as I'm learning something new, and as long as I'm enjoying it, then it doesn't really matter how much money I'm currently making at it, as long as I I'm making enough to at least survive. Because I've known for myself since even middle school or high school that I do best at the things that I'm passionate about, and so. Whenever I make a career move, I think to myself, all right, which one of these things am I more passionate about? Which fork on this, which path down in this fork looks like the more exciting one and the one that I'm going to enjoy more. And generally the one I'm going to enjoy more is the one I'm going to do better at. And so hopefully that leads to, career success down the line, which luckily it's worked out so far.
All right, guys, I hope you found that interesting with Kenji. Make sure you check out the full episode in my podcast library as well. My next person on the agenda was Scott Heimendinger of Inova Precision. I've been following Scott for a long time. Scott is one of the first ones who created the home user sous vide circulators with Sancerre. They all came up about the same time with Chef Steps and Jewel and Inova. They're all about the same time released their home-based sous vide circulators. Scott also worked at Modernist Cuisine and a few other places. And he is the lead architect and the engineer and developer of the Inova Precision Oven. And that's a lot of what we talked about on the episode. So hope you enjoy mine and Scott's discussion on the Inova Precision Oven. We're going to talk about the Inova Oven. And you came on board to kind of spearhead this, correct?
So yeah, very early on in the project, so Inova years ago had announced that they wanted to do an oven, and then they got acquired by Electrolux, and that project got delayed and delayed. Not quite 2 years ago, I got a call from Steve, CEO of Inova, we had. We've been very friendly over the years with Sons, even though we were competitors. I've been to their office and our teams had hung out together at industry events and all that kind of stuff. So it's been a friendly relationship. And Steve, plus their new head designer, Harry, said, "Hey, what do you think about steam ovens?" And I said, "I think they're inevitable. You're talking about combi ovens, right?" He said, "Yeah." And I said, "Yeah, they're like, from the modernist cooking revolution, like two things were inevitable, sous vide and combi ovens. And he said, well, why haven't combi ovens caught on? And I said, because nobody's done a good one for home cooks yet and tackled both the technology and the education. And I think that confirmed what he was hoping, like what he already knew was true, but was hoping to hear. And from then on, I was involved in the project and got to have got to participate really heavily in R&D along with fabulous product design team and the Electrolux teams that kind of helped manage some of the factory stuff. And yeah, from inception to helping weigh in on which features it should have and how it should work and the design of the app, I've been extremely lucky to be involved in this product since basically the beginning.
So again, it's something to where you took something that wasn't on the market. You were building it from scratch. You were taking something that's available in the commercial side in the restaurants, but is extremely expensive. The restaurant combi ovens are like $40,000 or so, and they have to be.
Yeah. For if you want the, you know, self parking feature, that one might run you $40,000.
Yeah. And they gotta be, you know, most of them are like tied into your water line. They're not, you know, they don't, you
that's
know,
right.
Fill them
and
up.
They require enormous electrical circuits and commercial permitting and the whole nine yards.
And the funny thing is, I know that when the big controversy, like in New York City and stuff over sous vide with the health departments, they actually went to combi ovens. But then again, not, you know, everybody and their brother can afford that type of pricing. They did it more as a necessity to keep the restaurant going and they could write it off and all that. But, yeah. You know, combi ovens have been out there a while and they're very, like I said, just like sous vide was back in the days when you said, look, you know, we need to do something to make it to the home cook. You guys are doing it with the combi oven with this precision, the Innova precision oven. So walk us through how you guys started developing this. Since did you just do the same thing? You looked at what was already available commercially and say, all right, let's shrink this down and try to put as many features in as possible.
Well, the feature thing was really important. It was, you know, what do we want the oven to be able to do for the end user? And there were a couple of things that came up really early as this is what we need to aim for. It needs to be really precise because home ovens are not very good at holding the temperature that you set. You can set your dial to 375, but if you actually stick a thermometer in there and you log the data, you'll see this huge wiggly kind of sine looking wave where it's above the temperature, it's below the temperature. And with that being the case, like you have to babysit. You can't just rely on, hey, it worked this way yesterday, it's going to work this way today. There's way too much uncertainty. So precision was just table stakes from the beginning. But then the second thing, which we can get into whenever is appropriate, is we needed to control wet bulb temperature. Wet bulb is the temperature that food actually experiences when it's cooking. But this is something that's new terminology for almost everybody. And in order to do that, you have to be able to sense differently than a normal oven senses. So we actually had to invent that sensing capability. The way combi ovens do it, the commercial ones, uses a type of sensor that's just way too expensive to put in a home version of a product. So we had some invention work that we did for that. And then a ton of decisions about, you know, How big is big enough? How big is too big? Because we want you to be able to do real cooking, but also fit it in a normal kitchen and all of these sorts of things. And so we've got so many iterations and hours of testing and design meetings and engineering and monitoring and data logging, the whole thing that went into trying to make the best oven we possibly could.
So let's take a back step and explain to people what this oven can actually do, because I don't think a lot of people understand that it can actually cook just like sous vide in this oven without a bag or with a bag. You can put a bag on it if you want.
But that's right. Yeah.
Exactly what this thing can do besides being a good convection oven on top of that.
Sure. So if you want to just make your grandma's cookie recipe, just like, you know, you always did, you can do that in this oven. Just because it's a combi oven, just because it has steam capability, doesn't mean you always need to cook with steam. So that's thing number one. You can bake your cookies or whatever your traditional stuff. It's going to hold temperature better. It's going to heat up faster. That's all groovy. But the real power, and I think the reason it's relevant for folks like us, and I think for your audience here, is because it allows you to achieve the same results and the same sort of cooking approach that you do in a sous vide bath, but without having to set up the bath and without necessarily having to bag your food. Although sometimes there are good reasons to throw your food in the bag. And that part, once you sort of get it, once you really absorb what that means to be able to do sous vide style cooking, but not in a bath, it's mind-blowingly convenient. And all that sort of knowledge and experience and intuition that you've already built up from sous vide cooking, you know, like, what's your favorite temperature to cook a ribeye, for example?
134.
134. Great. Set your oven to 134 in sous vide mode, and you get the same results that you already know and love. So it, even though it's different, you get to take all that expertise that you've accumulated from sous vide cooking and apply it directly here.
Yeah. So it's precision temperature cooking that you can't get in any other oven.
That's right. Because,
like you said, if you stick a thermometer in your regular oven, even if it's a convection oven at your house, since it's cooking with air, and this is, you know, on your smoker, your grill, the same way. Anything that's cooking with air, it can't really control the heat, you know, the temperature, because it's the air just does not conduct the heat well, and it's always moving around, and it can be different temperatures in every part of the oven. So what makes the steam, you know, make this different?
So two things. So we're like, science alert. We're about to
nerd out.
We're going to go a level deeper into Inception here. So I mentioned wet bulb temperature, but I'll take just a minute to explain it, because it is so important, but it's something that, like, you never hear about. Nobody teaches you about this. No cookbooks talk about this, but it's everywhere. We're all used to thinking that temperature is one thing. You stick a thermometer in the air, you stick a thermometer in your smoker, whatever it reads, that's the temperature. That is technically dry bulb temperature. So it's what a thermometer measures in air. But that's not the temperature that your food experiences. And that's because your food is wet. Even things you don't think of as wet have a lot of water. Like white bread has like 35%+ water content, right? You think of bread as dry, but no, it really is wet. And wet foods experience different temperature than a purely dry thing because of evaporation. So think of it this way. You go into a sauna, right? A dry sauna, and the temperature in the sauna might be really hot, might be above 150 degrees Fahrenheit, right? You start to sweat, that sweat evaporates off your body always stays at a safe temperature, right? It's because when the water evaporates off the surface of something and turns into steam, that actually cools off what's left behind. It's called evaporative cooling. And it's actually the reason for the barbecue stall, but we can come back to that. So that means that as long as evaporation is taking place, the temperature that your food experiences is different than the temperature of just the dry air. And that temperature minus evaporative cooling, that is wet bulb temperature. Okay, does that make sense so far?
Yeah, and I discovered this, and I didn't discover it, but I mean, personally, I figured this out when I first started cooking sous vide, and I took a spatchcock chicken and I cooked it sous vide at 148 degrees. I didn't chill it or anything. I took it on and I put it in my smoker, which was set at like 275 to crisp the skin. And I stuck my instant read or my probe to monitor the internal temperature. And I sat there and I watched it, and the internal temperature of the chicken did not raise. You know, it took 10 to 15, 20 minutes before the internal temperature started going up. Uh-huh. So I'm figuring out, going, you know, since it was already at 148 degrees, I guess it just kind of sat there, and it didn't, you would think it would automatically start rising, going up to 150, 160, and all of a sudden it's overcooked, but it didn't do that. It just sat there for the longest time before the internal temperature started rising. So is that similar to what you're talking about?
Yeah. What you're describing is sort of a type of barbecue stall. And it's because at that temperature, when the stall actually happens, you know, if you watch that curve where you stall up, that stall happens when the amount of cooling from evaporation equals the sort of amount of energy that's being put into the meat, when they're equal for a while, until the surface gets dry enough that evaporation reduces, and then you can start climbing up in temperature again.
So since there's so much moisture left in that chicken after I took it out of the sous vide, that's why it's not getting as hot, because
that's
it's
right.
still evaporating some of that moisture that's in there.
But off the surface in particular. Yeah. So put a pan in wet bulb temperature. Remember, it is the temperature of the air minus evaporative cooling. Okay. So let's imagine a slightly different scenario here. You're going to go back into that sauna, except this time, instead of being a dry sauna, it's a completely humid sauna, right? After a few seconds in that sauna at the same temperature, you are at like risk of mortal peril, right? You don't feel relaxed. You're literally, your body starts cooking. So why is that? Why does the humidity, being in a humid sauna, why is that so much more unbearable than being in a dry sauna? Well, air can only hold so much water. There's a maximum, and we use the term relative humidity as a measure of how much water is in the air versus how much it can hold. You might recognize the term from like the weather forecast. So, you know, it's a humid day, you know, humidity is 92% or whatever. They're talking about relative humidity. In that humid sauna, the air is already saturated. It's holding as much water as it can take, which means that when your skin sweats, there's no room for the sweat to evaporate. It can't go anywhere. And because it can't evaporate, it can't cool off. So you're not cooking at, you know, that lower temperature with evaporative cooling anymore. You're cooking at that 150 degrees Fahrenheit or whatever the sauna is at. So when you're at full humidity, the wet bulb temperature and the dry bulb temperature are the same. Right? No more evaporative cooling. That's what happens inside a sous vide bag. A sous vide bag, when it's sealed, there's a little bit of moisture on your food or whatever, and there's a tiny little bit of air left in the bag. You never really get all of it. There's a tiny amount left. When you start heating up that food, all the water that can evaporates into that small amount of air, and it reaches 100% relative humidity. We can do the same thing in the oven. We can, by adding steam, by adding humidity into the cooking environment, you can saturate the air so there's no more evaporative cooling that takes place. And your food sitting in here, not necessarily in a bag, experiences the exact same cooking conditions you get if it were sealed in a bag in a bath.
All right, guys, that was a pretty good one with Scott. Make sure you check out the full episode in my podcast library. You check it out on YouTube and or on anywhere you get podcasts. But the next one was a guy I followed for a long time that kind of inspired me to start this whole fire and water cooking concept with the, you know, the Facebook group, the YouTube channel and all that. Mr. John Setzler of Man Cave Meals. I ran into John on his first venture, which was Kamado Guru, is a group, like an old bulletin board type group that I found when I first started playing around with Kamado grills. And me and John had a conversation about that. I've had him on the show a couple times, but this last one, we kind of went back into his history and we kind of talked a little bit about how he got started. So hold on and listen to what John Setzler of Man Cave Meals had to say. Let's talk about how you got started with the Kamado Guru and all that.
Okay, well, Kamado Guru came about shortly after I got my first Kamado grill, which was the Char Griller Acorn, and a lot of people have started out with that grill. It's a steel Kamado, $299 from Lowe's, and it does a very good job for what it is. It's an inexpensive way for people to get into Kamado grilling, and there weren't very many people using that grill when I first got mine, and I had actually gone to YouTube to look for some information on that grill before I bought it, and I didn't find any, and that set off a few alarms that were good alarms, actually. That tells me, you know, I've got an opportunity here. If I buy that grill and make some video content using that grill, I'm going to be one of the first guys on YouTube with it. So that's what I did. And then I built the forum to try to get more Kamado users together. I could not find a Kamado forum anywhere either. And to my knowledge, there's still not one. I haven't actually gone out and looked for another one lately, but I think the KamadoGuru.com website is the only dedicated forum for Kamado owners out there. And it grew fairly rapidly. I put a lot of time and a lot of work into it, making content to go on that site. And it does fairly well now. It's got, I think, we're close to 20,000 members there. I haven't looked at that number lately, but the forum activity kind of slowing down a little bit. It's in this day and time, I think Facebook has taken the front seat in that arena, and there's not quite as much activity on the .com forum as there used to be.
So you're saying that you started growing the regular website, and then Facebook kind of slowly took it over, right?
It did. I decided several years after I started KamadoGuru.com to start the Kamado Guru Facebook page. And even it didn't take very long with the Kamado Guru Facebook page for it to grow. It doesn't have as many members as the KamadoGuru.com website does, but it has a lot more active members. The number of posts per day on the KamadoGuru.com website is a lot higher, or a lot lower, than on the Facebook page. Facebook page gets a lot more content, but there is a lot of content there. You can see that Kamado Guru, or that Kamado Cooking and Discussion Forum there, has 231,000 posts in it. So yeah, there's a vast amount of knowledge on that site. Most of my site traffic on that site lands people there through Google searches. And that's just how that site works these days. But the number of new posts on that site every day is not very much compared to the Facebook group.
Yeah. But still, you're going to get a lot of traffic. And like you said, there's a lot of content on there that you can't pull over from Facebook. So it's always a good resource for people. 36,000, like you said, you started with the Acorn. And that was one of the things when I first found you, is that's what made me buy my Acorn, because that's exactly what I did. I bought my Acorn because I saw several people on the Kamado Guru say, what you should do is buy something cheaper to see if you like this style of cooking before you make that type of investment. And that's the type of person I am. I don't want to go out and spend $1,000 on something and not know if I'm going to like that type of cooker. So the $250 to $300 range that the Acorn is in fit the, wallet, that I, needed to be able to budget to talk the wife into. And then, gave me the opportunity to try out that type of cooking. Not to saying that an Acorn is exactly like a Kamado Joe or a Big Green Egg, but it's very similar, and it's a similar type of cooker.
Exactly. The Acorn, when I bought that Acorn, I had saved up the money to buy a Big Green Egg, and I was planning to go the very next week to a friend of mine's shop and buy the Big Green Egg. I had not seen the Acorn, and I didn't know anything about it. But when I stumbled across it, I said, I'm willing to throw $300 at that to see if it's usable or not. And then if I don't like it, I'll go back and buy the Big Green Egg. Well, I put it through its paces. I cooked on it pretty hard for 6 or 7 months and still decided even after that, that I still wanted a ceramic cooker. But during that time and the advent of KamadoGuru.com, I learned that the Big Green Egg wasn't the only player in that game. And that's mainly why I ended up with something else and went with Kamado Joe instead.
Now, before you got that acorn, did you do any kind of social media at all? I mean, you didn't start any YouTube videos or anything like that until you got that cooker. Is that correct?
No, I had done some videos on YouTube prior to getting the acorn. The acorn was not my first videos. I had done some video content on a Weber kettle and on my Weber Smoky Mountain before I got the acorn. But I didn't have much of a following until I got the acorn. The acorn's what made my subscriber count go way up and go way up quickly.
Now, did your excitement about cooking, you know, and starting that, you doing more content go up when you got the acorn and then when you got the Kamado Joe?
Absolutely. The acorn, once I started getting a lot of followers, and at this time, when I say a lot of followers, I'm talking about maybe 4,000 or 5,000 followers on YouTube. It started to get fairly exciting. I was also following some of the other barbecue guys like Troy, for instance, Greg Mervich, Alan Johnson out in California, and a couple other people. We kind of ran together. We had a little group. We supported each other, and we were all growing our channels. But things started to change dramatically when I started getting emails from people saying, hey, can I send you my product to try out and use on your channel? That's when things start to really get exciting, as you already know.
I hope you enjoyed that with John Setzler. Make sure you check out the full episode again on my podcast library. All right, the next one. I've had this couple on a couple times. Actually, I think the first time I had just Susie Bullock of Hey Grill Hey on, and then I had Todd, her husband, on with her last time and in 2020. And I really love talking to these guys because they're down to earth just like me. They have the same philosophy on cooking as I do. They just want to help and teach and bring things to people in a way they can understand it so that they can make better food. So, Hey Grill Hey, Susie Bullock and Todd Bullock, great, great family. Great. If you ever watch their videos, check out their Facebook group, check out their website and all that. But here you go with Susie and Todd Bullock of Hey Grill Hey. And to me, there's no perfect way or the only way to do it. And that's what I kind of focus on. And that's, I think that's what, since you have such a diversity of your videos and your recipes, that's the kind of people that you attract.
Yes.
You just don't show, all right, here's how I'm going to cook a brisket on a stick burner, you know, like 100 times the same thing, you know, which there's people that's what they want, you know. You know, competition cooking, you know, or where, you know, you're cooking it for a judging competition where they only want it a certain way or there's very, very, you know, little room to wiggle or make it your own, you know. There seems to be a lot of these type of classes and stuff getting a lot more popular, of course, like with Masterclass, and there's a couple barbecue ones out there now that like a lot of the competition barbecue people are putting together. But I think yours is so much different because it's focused on somebody cooking in his backyard and wanting to cook for their family, not competitors or, you know, going there and seeing who's, you know, brisket got a 10 out of, you know, whatever. It's to actually please your family and your friends.
And that's what it's all about. And hold on, I'll really fast. One thing that we say all the time is that this is designed to be a stepping stone. Yeah. You know, we don't care what you're cooking on. We'll give you guidelines for time and temperature. We'll give you guidelines on how to build your own rubs and sauces so that you can create flavor profiles that you like in your own home, in your own backyard. It's not some secret formula of 3 rubs and 4 sauces that you can only get for $12 a piece down at the local barbecue pro shop. It's very much designed to be a good foundation for better barbecue at home.
Yeah.
you're the one who knows your own tastes, and that's
exactly.
I try to tell people all the time, create your own rubs. It's fine. I use, you know, store-bought rubs and pre-made rubs occasionally if I like them, but I love creating my own rubs because I know how much salt I like. I know how much sugar I like in a rib rub. I know how much pepper. I know how much, you know, my own palate and what my family likes. So I can adjust that. And it's very simple, and it's actually cheaper than going and, you know, paying, you know, for some big barbecue guy's rub that, you know, it's the same ingredients you could whip up yourself and probably, you know, adjust it to your own palate so much easier.
And that's what's kind of fun is we actually, I mean, we're in the rub and sauce game too. We sell our rubs and sauces, but most of our recipes are on the website. If you want to make them for free or just for the cost of ingredients, absolutely, please do that. And then you can customize it, because even today we got an email from somebody who said, oh, that sweet rub is too spicy. But we'll get an email on the same day from somebody else that says, man, that sweet rub is too sweet. Like, there's no way with a bottled rub to be able to please every single person's palate. But when you are making something from scratch, you can taste, you can adjust. And that's actually another one of our master classes in the Grill Squad is making your own rubs and sauces. Because I think it's such an important building block of barbecue, and it's something that really allows the backyard home cook to elevate their game and, you know, really bring a level of something they're excited about. But if they love our stuff and they would like to purchase it for convenience, totally an option.
Like I said, I buy pre-made rubs too. I adjust pre-made rubs.
A lot of people do.
Somebody gave me a big thing of Bad Byron's butt rub once, and that stuff is so salty, and I adjusted it. But, you know, I could take that rub that's a pre-made rub and make it my own by, you know, adding some sugar to it, or, you know, putting some garlic or something that knocks down the salt. So, you know, you can adjust store-bought rubs to your own taste as well. So it's just giving people the confidence to be able to, you know, create their own taste or know what their taste is. That's what I love doing as well. So
it was really cool. So we also do monthly challenges in the Grill Squad. So I think for May, the monthly challenge was to watch that masterclass about creating your own rub and sauce and coming up with your own and submitting the recipe. And then for the live video that month, Susie and I made those rubs and sauces and tasted them live and picked a winner. Yeah. So we do giveaways. We're always giving our products away, and we're finding people that want to partner with us that they'll want to do a specific discount code. But it's really cool because a lot of people after 6 months or so, you know, it's $75 a year, but people will continue to pay that. We found just because they want to stick in the community. They just want to stay there, and they want to be the person that's, you know, offering help in the Facebook group, you know, because they figured it out. And we actually saw it in action. We in our new house, our neighbor joined the Grill Squad, and he smoked his first brisket yesterday, and he nailed it on his first try. So like what we did with the masterclass is it took us 5 to 10 briskets until, you know, we really mastered the brisket. And now, not even then. Yeah, we still don't master it, but like to the point where it's like showable and edible to a crowd. Yeah. Right. But he nailed it on his first try, and he gave us some, and we were able to share that with our family, and our kids loved it and ate it. And I don't know. I think the knowledge that she has in her brain and the way that she's able to, you know, present that to people in video form, it's incredible. And I think people catch onto that and they learn from it and they love it. And I think that's why it's been so successful.
Hey, all, Inkbird's got a few new great products this year. And one of them is their brand new vacuum sealer. Has a very compact design, but has all the functions that you would need. Has a dry and moist option, plus a seal and vacuum seal button, and a stop button, plus a built-in bag cutter. It's small enough to fit in your drawer or take with you on vacation. So it also has an accessory attachment for any containers that use any other vacuum sealer brand containers. Check it out, guys. It's like $60 right now on Amazon, so it's also very affordable. And it's an Inkbird, so I know it's a good product. So check it out in the link below. Check out Inkbird products, and back to the show.
I just love
Susie and Todd Bullock, they're great. I hope you got something out of that. But check out Hey Grill Hey on their website, Facebook group, and all that. So my next guest was, I've had him on before, but I like having Eric Villegas from Backmaster Fresh on because he's got a lot of energy. He's got a lot of experience. He's owned restaurants. He's had his own cooking TV show on PBS. And he's got a really great personality, and I really loved talking to him. And in this clip, we talked about TV shows, the food cooking shows. So hope you enjoy this with Eric Villegas of Backmaster Fresh. So you have a personality that would work really well on TV. Have you ever thought of doing any of these Food Network type shows, going on like Chopped or anything like that?
Well, you know, having the opportunity to do a PBS cooking show for 8.5, almost 10 years, depending how you look at it, it was an incredible opportunity. Would I like to do another one? Of course. But the landscape has changed drastically. My show, Fork of the Road, that I created with my good friend Scott Allman, who also was a photographer and did all the video work. He basically developed the whole show, and I just kind of walked down and cooked. Would I like to do it again? Sure. Do I see it happening? Probably not. It's a completely different landscape. The funding on PBS is extremely difficult to navigate because you can't really get sponsors for ads because of the way PBS works. So you need more of an underwriter, and that's a very difficult thing to do. TV shows, especially traveling food shows, are not cheap to produce. As far as Chopped and the competitive shows, I have no interest in doing competitive cooking show at all. As a young man, when I was cooking in my restaurants, I would always get asked to do, you know, the pork competition or the milk competition. And I just didn't see any point. What I wanted to do and what I did, every night I had a contest to make the best food I could for my customers. And the idea of going off and doing a contest just
nothing to gain for you.
I just didn't see any reason to do it. So I don't even watch those competitive shows. I don't find them to be necessarily real. I don't find that. I mean, it's good television, but culinarily speaking, I think it's a bit odd. And I had I was fortunate enough years ago on my television show to interview a lot of chefs, and Mario Batali was on my show a couple times, and we were discussing Iron Chef, and that's an interesting show. And what I was told was that they know exactly what the main ingredient or the surprise ingredient is going to be, but it's one of two. So let's say like sea bass or steak. So their whole team will work on a sea bass and steak recipe for a week or 2 weeks or whatever the lag time is. And then when it comes to the actual show and they do the big reveal, you see everybody jump to work immediately. And
yeah, right.
They can talk to anybody. Why? Because they know it's either going to be one of two, and then they go ahead and do it. And then that limited amount of time that they have, 45 minutes or an hour, whatever it is, was, again, my understanding was to produce just one plate of food. When you see them doing all the food for the judges, they get another hour to do all that. Yeah. So, and it's not, I don't mean to say it's a sham. It's not at all. I mean, it's still great television, and their culinary prowess is definitely something to be admired, but it's not quite what they're representing. And that's the kind of stuff that I don't really enjoy being involved with, but I get it. And I'm an idiot because everybody loves it. So what the hell do I know?
Well, all right, guys. In about halfway through 2020, I started bringing on my friends from the Facebook groups, Lloyd Capuccio and Kevin Liddell. We hit it off pretty good on the Facebook groups. We all have similar interests in cooking, and we have a similar mindset of wanting to know the whys of things, how they work and why they work and all that. We don't just take things for granted and take people's word for things. We want to see the evidence. So I love having these guys on. I've been doing it about once a month where we take a certain topic and break it down. And this particular clip, Lloyd and I were talking about charcuterie. Dry aging, the whole episode was on dry aging meat. And this section here was about charcuterie, what it is, how to do it, and take a listen. Maybe it'll get you interested in listening to the whole episode where we talked about dry aging in general. So let's talk about charcuterie, which is dry aging, but there's also some other things involved, like curing and all that. So since you're the big charcuterie person, Lloyd, I know you've done a lot of
making
salamis and stuff like that. How much different is that than dry aging?
You still have to have a controlled environment to pull it off. So let's talk whole muscles, which would be likened to doing a whole primal. So when you're going to cure a whole muscle, let's say a beef tenderloin. There's a good example. I did one. It was an Italian one. That was amazing. You only need salt, but I prefer using cure number two, prey powder number two, which is a nitrite and nitrate combination that allows for time release. So the nitrates turn into nitrites, and it takes a very, very, very long time. But again, you got to control the moisture, the temperature, and the environment. And that's where I use the umami bags also for that. And it works great.
Yeah. I know they have some that are specifically sized for charcuterie, and they have videos.
They work great.
Instructions on how to do it. And in case people don't know what charcuterie is, because I know it's a fancy French word, but it's usually, salamis, pepperonis, prosciutto, things like that, that you're going to, cut up into like a cheese board. Or I think the definition of charcuterie is deli, right? Isn't it?
I don't think so. Google it. I don't know.
I think I looked it up and that's kind of what it means.
I'll look it up right now.
It's all those sausages you see hanging from the ceiling and hams and things like that where they're not just
it does. I looked it up. Charcuterie. It says delicatessen. French. English is delicatessen.
So it's that stuff that we normally see hanging from you go into an Italian meat market or something, you see all that stuff hanging, and you got hams and sausages. Cool. And
so I do want to touch on one thing. So with whole muscles, whether it's a ribeye or pork, whatever, you really don't technically need to use curing salts, nitrites, or nitrates. Okay, you don't, because it's a whole muscle, because the interior of the meat is sterile. Okay. However, when it comes to beef, the advantage of using prey powder number two or cure number two is that beef fat tends to go rancid. So if you're making a bourgeola from the eye of round, you got to cut off all the fat. You could just use salt. But if you got to cut like a ribeye, and I've done ribeyes, I've done tenderloins, I've done whole primal ribeyes, and I've done the whole thing. You got to use cure number two because the nitrites and nitrates will prevent the rancidity. In pork, you don't have an issue. You could do a whole ham with just salt and get great results. You don't need the curing salts. When it comes to sausages, of course, you need the curing salts.
Gotcha. So, what kind of process do you normally go through when you're making charcuterie? Do you normally like grind, you start with just chunks of meat, grind it up?
Are we talking like whole muscle or like sausages?
Well, like sausages. Let's do like, a salami or pepperoni or something like that.
Well, okay. So if I'm doing a pepperoni, let's see. I usually introduce a bacterium also to it, which is not a requirement, but it kind of speeds up the process. But while my grind usually is I'll cut all the meat up, I'll put all the spices in it, and then I grind. I think I get a better result. You don't have to use a bacterium, but the bacterium helps lower the pH down to a proper percentage to avoid the bad, nasty bacteria that could just damage your product.
All right, guys. I hope you got a little bit out of that as well. Lloyd and Kevin are great to have on. I'm going to have them on more next year, of course, as well. I like breaking down topics with them. But one of the things
the highlight of my year for 2020 was being able to participate in the International Sous Vide Association's online sous vide summit. It had to be done virtual this year, of course, because of COVID. But I think it got more people involved. I think you got a lot more people who may not have been able to fly to San Francisco to attend, were able to do so virtually this year. And I think they learned something from that, that they're going to go ahead and offer that going forward, because they'll be able to attract more people and more people be able to learn from it. But one of the things that I really love is being a part of the International Sous Vide Association, where I can talk with industry professionals and other crazy people like me who just love to do this stuff on their own. So here's a clip from when I had Jason Logsdon and Mike Lishardi on discussing the International Sous Vide Association's Sous Vide Summit. Let's talk about the Sous Vide Summit. You know, we had a couple of podcast episodes talking about last year's and all that. Let's kind of just touch base on what happened last year, and then we'll kind of walk into what's going on this year.
Cool. Yeah, last year was in the very same city where I had the Tiny Figurine Collector of America moment in Wilmington, Delaware. So that was kind of full circle.
It was destiny.
It was destiny, you know. But what an incredible weekend it was. I mean, about 130, 140 just lovers of sous vide in all shapes and forms came together. And, of course, our title sponsors last year were Cray and Cuisine Solutions, and they just blew everybody out of the water with everything that they did. And, you know, Polyscience and Vacmaster and all of these amazing companies that stood behind us and really helped us make the vision a reality. Lots of fantastic food. We had, I think we had about 24 speakers last year, 24, 25. And it's just a whole bunch of great sessions ranging from everything from, you know, sous vide Q to sous vide Beyond Steak on through sous vide pie making.
Cryo concentration.
Yes. And I think what was really special last year and what this kind of goes back to why we're here and what the association is all about, the community building between the professionals and the home cooks and everybody, it was just something special to kind of behold. That sounds trite, but you know, you've got these Cray and Cuisine Solutions that are like, you know, the most experienced, like their chief scientist is Dr. Bruno Gousseau, who invented the method. And like, they know more, AJ's forgotten more than I will ever know if I were to go to school for the rest of my life, and Gerard. And then you've got all of the home cooks, and the pros are sharing with us that, wow, I didn't know people actually use sous vide for that, because the home cooks were experimenting with things. It was just a really cool interplay of different people from different walks of life coming together, sharing a passion and enjoying a great weekend together.
Go ahead, Jason.
What surprised me the most was with so many different speakers, I was expecting to go in that I've been doing sous vide for a decade. I know a lot about it. You know, Dave Petranzik from Polyscience has been selling it in some of the, you know, top kitchens in the world for, you know, at least as long. There's a lot of people that are really, really knowledgeable about sous vide. And so I expected it to be good, but to not necessarily come away with like learning a whole ton just because I've been sous viding for a really long time. And there were so many different sessions that I learned stuff in, and you would look over and you'd see, you know, David was taking notes in the crowd, even though he teaches, you know, Michelin chefs like how to use sous vide in the restaurants. And I don't think there's a single person that attended, whether a speaker or just an attendee, that didn't learn new things about sous vide that they had no idea that it could be used for.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the things that attracted me to the whole idea and the association and the event is it's not just an industry event. It's not just for, you know, professional chefs or people that are in the industry, you know, that work for, you know, the equipment manufacturers or suppliers or what have you. You have a bunch of these, you know, weirdos like me and you that are just, you know, love to experiment and try new things and love to learn. And like you said, teach. I mean, I know that I talked to Meathead after, you know, I had him on after last year's summit, and he said he sat in just about every,
you know, speaker's event that he could and took notes. And, you know, he learned a whole lot that he never even knew, even though he's, you know, been, you know, playing around with Sous Vide and barbecue, you know, before I even started doing it. He, you know, that's the thing. When you get a bunch of people that are, you know, enthusiastic and, you know, excited about something, you know, and they love to learn and try new things, we can all teach you each other something. And
yeah,
that's what I got from everybody that I talked to that attended last year. That's what it was. It was all these, you know, regular people getting together with, you know, industry, you know, experts and all learning from each other, which I think that's what makes this a lot better, you know, event than, let's say, you know, a industry event, you know, or something like that, you know, like a, just a, you know, professional, you know, chef's event or something like that. Well, all right, folks, that was the best of 2020. I wish I could run it for 3 hours because there's a lot more clips I would like to have included, but I think those are some of the better ones for 2020. Looking forward to 2021, where we can continue this. This will be our second, or going into our third year of the podcast, and it continues to grow. We continue to get some great guests. I hope you enjoy it. Make sure you follow us on Facebook, Instagram. Check out the Fire and Water Cooking YouTube channel. Also, make sure you check out the Fire and Water Cooking Cookbook on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, anywhere you find books. Also, check out the Fire and Water Cooking website, fireandwatercooking.com. Thanks for joining me. I'll see you again in 2021.